This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. In his inaugural address last week, Governor Phil Scott said the state is facing some difficult budget decisions, including a $70 million budget gap for the coming fiscal year. Scott said one of his challenges is to close this gap without raising any taxes or fees and without hurting key social programs.
We cannot continue passing budgets that grow faster than the economy or wages of working Vermonters. I will set clear limits that reflect the changes working families see in their own finances. I will not support or carry out experiments at taxpayers' expense, and I will only sign a budget that meets these standards.
The governor also talked about enacting major education reforms, plans that would put more money into early education and higher education without increasing the state's overall education budget. How is he going to achieve these goals? These are some of the questions we have for him today. Governor Phil Scott, welcome back to the program and your first program as governor.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Bob, for having me on.
So it's the end of the second week, settling in?
Well, it was starting to. Actually, it's been 1 week thus far. Maybe the first day was interesting. The day after the inaugural address, I went, and I've worked in the construction industry for most of my life, so I'm an early riser, work long hours. And so that was no different. The Friday morning came to Montpelier and decided to get an early start. So I was down in the pavilion about 6:30. And there's not a lot of activity on the fifth floor at that time of day. So then I decided to go to the State House because I had an early meeting there about 7:30. So before 7, went up there, went up with the detail, went into the building, up the stairs to the new office, and found we didn't have a key to get in. So I went down to the Sergeant at Arms office. Of course, there wasn't much activity there either, nor was there at the Capitol Police. So about that time, I was a little frustrated. I'm wandering around aimlessly in the State House where I've spent a lot of time over the last 16 years with no place to go. And so we were contemplating what to do. And I thought, I know how we can get in. And I went to see Kevin from the custodial staff and asked Kevin if he could let me in. And he said, I most certainly can. And so it really connects with what I said in the inaugural address, when we have a problem, when I have a problem over the years, I typically go to those who were in the trenches to help me get through it for advice and opportunity. So I thought it was fitting that the first day in office that someone on the ground, literally in the trenches, was able to get me out of a jam first thing in the morning.
Let's talk about your budget challenges coming up, the $70 million budget gap. You want to limit the growth of next year's budget to the percentage increase in salaries of working Vermonters. You've talked about that quite a bit. Now, the budget for the Human Services Agency accounts for about half of the overall state budget. So how are you going to achieve this goal without making some cuts in social programs?
Well, there are some challenges ahead. As was noted, we're facing about a $70 million gap in revenues. In fact, we'll be starting this fiscal year with less money than we had last fiscal year, even after all the changes that have been made in between. So to say it's daunting is maybe an understatement. But I believe it's doable, and I'm very proud of the team that I put together. The transition has been going very well, and putting people into place that understand the complexities and share my vision was important to me. Putting Al Gobe in as Secretary of Human Services, I think will prove to be a good move on our part. I have a great deal of respect for him, the way he looks at things strategically, the way he looks at things from a fundamental standpoint, structure. I think his business and as well as what he's learned in the healthcare front will lend itself well to finding efficiencies within the agency. So when you look for, again, half the budget is human services, you have to go where the money is. And I believe that we have some opportunity there. We're working through that as we speak. And we'll be detailing some of that in the budget address.
Are you looking at things like rolling back some of the eligibility criteria for programs like Medicaid?
We're across the board. during the campaign, as you might remember, I talked about the administrative costs within the Medicaid program, and they have grown over the last 7 years by $100 million, just administrative costs. And so I look for that, for opportunity in that respect alone. And I feel that we can do things more efficiently, more effectively, and try and save some of those dollars without cutting the programs, that are delivered to the most needy.
So when you say without cutting the programs, does that mean not changing the eligibility criteria?
Well, we'll take a look at that. I mean, that's obviously on the table. But I'm, you know, the first executive order that I signed was to the administration itself. And it's to take a look at how can we grow the economy. Everything that we look at in state government, I want to do so through the lens of growing the economy, making Vermont more affordable, as well as taking care of the most vulnerable. And so we'll follow through on that. And that's across all agencies, all departments, in order to really, really keep that on the front burner.
So are you making a commitment to Vermonters not to reduce programs, not to change eligibility criteria? Is that what you mean by?
I'm making the commitment that we're going to take care of those most vulnerable citizens, and that we will follow through on that. And there may be some changes in some of the programs, but again, it will be not to hurt those who need the help the most. It's just to be more efficient.
You can join the conversation here today at Vermont Edition. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Do you agree with Governor Scott that it's a mistake to raise taxes or fees to balance the budget? What are some of the key issues you want lawmakers to address? And we'll try to find out how Governor Scott stands on these issues. 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. In your speech last week, you said the state needs to rearrange its spending priorities on education. Here's what you said.
How else can we justify spending so little on early education and higher education? Well, we spend 25% of our entire state budget on the K-12 system. Investment in early education is a proven approach to reducing special education and health care costs. And our level of support for state colleges and universities ranks one of the lowest in the nation. That's why we must rethink our entire education spectrum.
So I want to make sure that I understand what you're saying. On one hand, what you're saying is we need to put more financial resources into early education because that's such an important program, affects people for their entire lives. We need to put more money into higher education because Vermont's support for higher education is one of the lowest in the country. But we're not going to increase the overall amount of money that we spend on education. So that means if you're going to raise more money for early ed and higher ed, you got to take some money from K through 12. Do I have that right?
You do. Here's the problem. We're educating 86,000 students in Vermont to the tune of $1.6 billion. That's 20,000 less kids than it was 20 years ago. So when you look, and it's about $19,000 per student, which is one of the highest in the nation, and we're not getting the results that we hope. When I look at that, and I see that, and I believe in the science, the studies that tell us that early childhood development is essential in helping with costs in the future, in providing for our citizens, in providing for more education to help those later in life. So you look at the entire amount of money that we're spending, and again, if I and you have some listeners on this program that are very intelligent, bright people, and if we went to any of them and any group of them and said, "Here's 86,000 kids, and we here's $1.6 billion, and we need you to educate them," I dare say that structure would look far different than it does today. So I'm saying let's look pre-K through 16. Let's broaden that, but let's utilize the money that we have that we're spending right today, and grow that and not spend any more money than we are today, but utilize those precious resources more efficiently and effectively, so that we get the education that our students deserve.
You've talked about the PICUS report and maybe looking at some of the recommendations of that report. You know, the number one recommendation was that Vermont's pupil-teacher ratios are too low. And if you change them by one or two or three, you could save a lot of money. Is that something you're looking at?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's difficult discussions to have. This isn't going to be easy by any stretch. As I said numerous times over the last few days, I probably shouldn't try and enjoy this honeymoon while I can, because when I give the budget address, it'll be honest. It'll be stark, but it'll be, I believe, set the tone for where we go in the future. I'll have more details on on education in particular in the budget address. But we really have to have a conversation about education reform in its entirety. Every single year that I've been involved in the legislature and the legislative process, I hear about the need for property tax relief. And I know that we educate fewer and fewer students every year. But we understand as well that giving them the jump start is probably going to be the give us the biggest bang for the buck later on in life. So we need to have the courage to think outside the box.
So do you see an educational reform policy of yours as saying we need to make the student-teacher ratio higher and to say to schools, this is what it's got to be?
No, I think that we need to set the expectations in terms of budgets. And so we'll be laying that out in the budget address.
Let's go to our callers and talk to Ted in Killington. Hey, Ted, welcome to the program.
Hi. I think that there's some abuse, perhaps, and some unintended consequences with the income sensitivity to the property tax. And I wonder if there's any political will to perhaps look at that. That's it.
All right, Ted, when you talk about abuse, could you be a little more specific?
Yeah, I think that you can structure a mortgage if you're property rich and income poor, say a retiree that has some money, $500,000 house, property tax is $10,000, but they only have $50,000 or $60,000 in income, they can get a huge property tax rebate. How about buying a house you can afford to pay the taxes on? And I don't think there's ever a time when, if, you know, 50 or 60% of people have income sensitivity, why they would ever go to a town meeting and vote down a budget? Their taxes will never go up.
Well, actually, Ted, people who support income sensitivity would say that the increase in their local spending is reflected even though they're paying based on their income and not on the value of their property. So that's actually an issue of active debate. But Governor Scott, what are your thoughts about this?
Well, I've heard the same things, Ted, as well, over the campaign and previous to that. There have been many who have pointed out that some of those the bigger, more elaborate homes, folks that have those, and some of the lakefront properties on Lake Champlain have actually have money coming back to them in terms of income sensitivity. And I don't believe that anyone had contemplated that for this. I think income sensitivity is about trying to help those who are having a difficult time, that are struggling to make ends meet, which there are a lot across Vermont who are in that category. That's why I spoke about this and why I'm talking about growing this economy and trying to solve this crisis of affordability that we find ourselves in. And property taxes are a big part of that. When I did my everyday jobs tour and worked side by sides in the shoes of others, I heard from many of those employees who said, you know, they're working two or three jobs just trying to make ends meet. And it is because they can't pay their property tax, or they can't pay their mortgage payments, or their rent payments, or you know, car payments, whatever it is, they're just struggling to get by, and it's A lot of it's our demographics and so forth. So we have to focus like a laser on our economy in order to grow our way out of this.
Do you think the program of income sensitivity is too generous?
Well, in some respects, it may have to be restructured. It may have to be capped. It may have to be some tweaks. But I think it's needed, at least in the short term, to provide relief for those who really can't afford to pay their property taxes. So, for some, it's essential. There are some that it's just an advantage for them. They may not need it, but it's an advantage, and they take advantage of it. And they should. I mean, that's the program. So. But I think we need to take a look at that. And I'm sure that there are many who feel the same way and are probably going to do it during this legislative session.
There's a bill that's been introduced in the Senate that would have everybody in the state pay their education tax based on their income and not the value of their property. The thinking being that people who are in income sensitivity pay somewhere around 2.5 or 3% of their income to support education. But folks who make a lot more money, perhaps it's only 1%. What are your thoughts about that bill?
Well, again, I think we've had a lot of talk over the last few years about whether there's an actual need to change the formula. And that's actually what they're probably getting at, is changing the formula in a much different way. And I don't mind having the discussion about doing that. But simultaneously, we have to have a discussion about the spending. Because you can rearrange the deck chairs, you can have a different formula, but it's just going to come out of a different pocket. Somebody's going to pay for it if we don't address the spending side. So I'm saying we need to address the spending side at the same time we're having these discussions.
So if I understand from the sponsors correctly, their plan would actually increase tax burdens on wealthier Vermonters and decrease burdens on middle-income Vermonters. I'm wondering if that's in conflict with your idea of no tax increases.
Yeah. Well, again, we have to be careful what we do, even with the – we don't have that many in Vermont who are wealthy, but we can't afford to lose any more either. Some of our tax laws, I think, encourage those who flee Vermont. And I know that there's been debate about that, and some would say that's not true, but I beg to differ. I speak with them every day. People who have left and are now citizens of Florida. You may not know they are. They still walk down the street. You may think they're still Vermont residents, but they aren't. They've moved on because of no income tax. And the inheritance tax is another burden for not a burden. It's just strategically doesn't make sense for them to stay here. So we need to make sure that we have even though we need more prosperity in Vermont across the board.
So just to be clear, this is a piece of legislation that you're willing to take a look at?
We'll take a look at anything anybody comes up with. I don't pretend to have all the answers, but we're always willing to listen. That's what I've done throughout my whole legislative life, is just to listen to others. You learn something, and then take a position afterwards. But I'm willing to at least have the conversation.
Today on the program, our guest is Governor Phil Scott. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today, Governor Phil Scott. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. You've talked during the campaign and certainly in your address about the importance of economic development, and you want to grow businesses in the state and how important that is. We did get this email from Allison, who would like to hear specifically how you will bring real jobs to Vermont, what kinds of incentives will be offered here for businesses, and also, will you make any changes to the tax code in order to keep retirees from fleeing the state? Let's start with the first one. Should the state be offering tax incentives to businesses to locate here?
I believe we should do anything we can. We need more economic tools in the toolbox. And as unpopular as maybe it is even today, the EB-5 program is something that I think we should continue to look at with some proper oversight and regulation. I do believe that tax incentives work. You don't have to look any further than, and whether you agree or disagree, take the renewable energy field. Take the tremendous growth we've seen over the last 5 or 6 years with solar arrays and so forth throughout Vermont. And that growth is because of tax incentives, tax credits. It's lucrative for the developers to do so. So let's take a page from that. If we want economic opportunity, if we want to grow the economy, grow the state, we may have to take some of those investments and try and get them here into the state. And while we can't compete toe-to-toe with New York and others, we can compete. We have a lot to offer. And it's across the board trying to do whatever we can to encourage them to come.
And on the second question about changes to the tax code in order to keep retirees from fleeing the state, during the campaign, you talked about exempting Social Security payments from state taxes. Are you going to pursue that?
That is a longer term goal. But yes, I don't believe we should be taxing a tax. I think we have an obligation to provide for our retirees. I think that's one way of doing it. Obviously, we won't be able to. I think it's about $30, $40 million a year. We're not going to be able to do it in this year. But I would like to put a plan in place where we can transition, wean ourselves away from that in the future, because that's an area that we need to protect our most vulnerable. Some of those are retirees, and I don't think it's fair to tax them. I'd also like to add that I would like to remove the tax on benefits for military retirees as well. I think that that's an area that I think needs some attention.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Donna in South Burlington. Hi, Donna. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking my call. This is actually based on a recent experience of mine with Vermont Health Connect, and I thought it would be interesting for the governor to comment on it. It seems like in Vermont they use a term called net income to determine eligibility for Medicaid, and I'm self-employed, and so I'm required to go through Vermont Health Connect, and last year I had some, you know, some extraordinary, not last year, the year before, I had some higher costs that weren't covered by my health insurance, and so I got a letter telling me I was eligible for Medicaid this year, and that was sort of a shock to me. And then they said, well, because I was eligible for Medicaid, if I didn't take it, I wasn't eligible for a premium subsidy. And I think that maybe Vermont is trying to get a lot of federal money or something, but eventually the state has to pay for these extra Medicaid costs, and I think it would be worth it for the governor's team to look at this net income thing, which is not actually in the law.
Interesting. Vermont Health Connect obviously has been something that I've been talking about in terms of the structure, the exchange itself, and I believe our need to transition away from that. And certainly with all the discussions in Washington on repealing the Affordable Care Act, I think we'll need to have a better understanding of what's going to happen. We're in a bit of a holding pattern in that regard. But at the same time, that's interesting that you brought that up, and I certainly will bring that back to the team. We've had some discussions, and as you might have seen, we put some commissioners and certainly our secretary in place at Human Services, and we're going to take a look at Vermont Health Connect in many different aspects and try and do whatever we can to make this work for Vermonters and provide for health care at a price they can afford.
You've talked about wanting to move from a state exchange to joining the federal exchange. With all the uncertainty in Washington, I mean, I think there's a lot of questions down there. The Affordable Care Act might be repealed early on, but it might not be replaced for, who knows, 6 months, a year, anybody's guess there. How do you make a decision, or will you make a decision, about moving to a federal exchange when you don't know What's happening down there?
Yeah, that has been the dilemma that we're facing. I made a commitment during the campaign to transition away from Vermont Health Connect. We still intend to do so at some point in time. But right now, there is so much uncertainty in D.C. About what they're going to do. And I would hope that any changes they make, if they decide to repeal the Affordable Care Act, that they will have a replacement for it. There's some good aspects of the Affordable Care Act that should remain in place. And hopefully that they will listen to governors throughout the country, because I'm not sure that everyone would agree that we should move forward without having something to replace it, not for any of our states.
So hearing you say that makes me think that it's unlikely that the administration will want to move to a federal exchange in the next 6 months or until things are settled in Washington.
Right. That's going to be difficult. We are working on another proposal, which I will outline in the budget address, that I think will help alleviate some of the issues revolving around Vermont Health Connect.
We've got a group of five Republican governors around the country, including Governor Kasich from Ohio, who are urging Congress, don't repeal the Affordable Care Act. Are you joining on to that effort?
I am. I would join on to the extent that if they want to replace it, that's fine. Let's have the discussion about that. Have something meaningful in place. Just for the sake of repealing it, that doesn't make any sense to me. Have another option in place for us to move towards. We in this state rely heavily on federal dollars. About a third of our budget is made up of federal money, so we can't afford to have any at this point in time, with a $70 million revenue downgrade now, and to have further federal dollars removed would be very much a challenge for us as we build this budget.
So you're talking about proposing a plan in your budget address to deal with health care. Will that be a short-term plan or something that is more midterm?
I would say it more midterm. We will be able to. I think this will help in many different ways.
And how will it work?
I'll let you know in the budget address.
Let's talk to Tim in Hyde Park. Hi, Tim. What's on your mind today?
Hi, good afternoon, and welcome, Governor Scott, to the office. I did not vote for you, but I've heard a lot of good things about you and the way that you conduct yourself and your approach to Vermont politics. And I take considerable comfort from that and the way in general that Vermont politics proceed sort of in a congenial but productive and constructive manner. And I appreciate that I've heard about you as well. So my question is, we here in Hyde Park, our village utility and others have constructed solar projects, and we're eyeing additional renewable energy projects down the road. And climate change is something I am very concerned about. I presume a lot of Vermonters are, and I know that your predecessor had been very concerned about climate change. What about you? What about your office? Do you have thoughts and policies that you're thinking about in terms of energy and climate change in the state of Vermont?
All right, Tim, thanks very much. We also got this email wanting to know, do you still support efforts to get to a 90% renewable energy goal by 2050? I've read it would take over 300 acres of solar to make up for the smallest wind farm in Vermont. Solar alone will not get us to 90% ever. What's your plan if wind is off the table? So let's start maybe more generically in a global sense looking at climate change.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you, Tim, for calling in. And after, as I've done over my years of public service, every election, I believe we're all politicians during the campaign. but it's the truly effective legislators and public officials who transition to becoming public servants. And that's what I've advocated for those I serve with, as well as myself. So I'm here to represent you, whether you voted for me or not, and I appreciate the call. So in terms of I believe in that the climate is changing, and I believe it is man-made, and I support and I believe that we can adhere to what's been put in place in terms of 90% renewables by 2050. Is it going to be difficult? Sure, just like anything else. It's going to take a change in technology as well. We've seen tremendous gains in the efficiency of even solar over the last decade, and I believe that we'll see more in the future. The game changer, I believe, across the country in the world, really, is about storage. You need to store have a high capacity for storage of energy. Once, and I know they're working on this on a daily basis, and once someone really breaks through with the technology to do that, the game's over. Then renewables will make much more sense so that you can create the have consistent baseload power. And I also believe that we should be utilizing as much hydro as possible. I mean, it's not just about solar; it's about hydro and biomass. We have energy-rich neighbors just to our north, and that's why I'm going to reestablish the good working relationship we've had with our neighbors to the north in Quebec, in particular. In fact, I'll be going soon up to on a mini trade mission to see what we can do to work together. But hydro would be one as well. But again, I want to make this clear. I am not supportive of destroying our ridgelines. I'm not supportive of wind development on our ridgelines. But again, as I said, have previously said, it's not that I'm anti-wind, I'm anti-ridgeline development.
You've talked about a two-year moratorium on ridgeline development for wind. Is that something that you're going to encourage the legislature to pass?
We are looking for every opportunity we can to stop the destruction of our ridgelines.
So you will ask them to take it?
We're going to look at all avenues in order to accomplish that goal.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Robert in Bethel. Hey, Robert, welcome to the program.
Bob, thank you. Hey, Governor Scott, congratulations on your win. I'm proud to have you up there in the State House. My question is specifically with regards to the lottery mystery. I always hear that 100% of the lottery proceeds go to the educational fund, and it's not a very transparent situation. So could you explain how the lottery dollars flow into the education fund and how it's flowed, taken out of the education fund, and where the money actually goes? Because to me it's just this huge mystery, and I wonder, because we have so many dollars in our education area that, you know, we need or we don't need, and it's just a question that I've asked the lottery commission. I was hoping maybe you could discuss that. And lastly, I have a new bumper sticker for Vermont. Rather than take back Vermont, it's tax back Vermont! ! I thought you might like that. But well, can you explain the lottery, how it works, how it flows?
Yeah, I wish I could, Robert. And I'm not trying to dodge the question. I will have an answer for you, and maybe we can talk about it the next time I'm on the program. Because I too believe that 100% of the proceeds go to the education fund, but again, I want to make sure that I'm clear on that as well. But I will come back to you if that's okay with you.
Philosophically, what do you think about the lottery? Should it be expanded as a way to generate more revenue for the education fund?
Yeah, I'm not sure about. I'm not supportive of expansion of the lottery. I believe that it's probably about right at this point in time. I don't want to be excessive in that regard because what it seems a bit regressive. I see many who are standing in line for lottery tickets when they're making choices about whether to get another gallon of milk or buy some lottery tickets, hoping for the big payoff. So I'm not trying to encourage that any further.
Today on the program, our guest is Governor Phil Scott. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today, Governor Phil Scott, and our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Richard in South Newfane. Hey, Richard, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I'm in the trenches in South Newfane. I drive a bunch of older cars, and I work on them myself. I make sure they're safe. And I jack them up before I go to my inspectors, who I've been going to for about 20 years. But starting in April, this is going to be some bureaucrat that doesn't know me, who's not looking at my car, and they're going to make the decision. It's going to cost more, so I consider this an added fee. And I'm not sure how many – I believe in the inspection, but I'm not sure how many accidents are caused by defective equipment as opposed to defective drivers. I feel that this is not a good thing for small garages who make some money off of inspections, who can't afford the new computer. And I also feel it's going to send a lot of poor people who can't afford a new car to drive illegally or to lose their jobs. So any comment on this?
Hey, Richard, could you just very briefly outline for us what the differences are as you see them?
What my inspectors have told me is they have to purchase around a $2,000 computer, which they have to take a picture of the car now. They're going to be linked into Montpelier, and this starts in March. And some guy in Montpelier, or woman, is going to look at the picture and listen to what the mechanic has to say. I'd rather the mechanic, who's standing right there, who's looking at the car, can look underneath it, make the decision like they have for the last 40 or 50 years, than somebody who probably doesn't even work on cars, but is looking at a book to see if it passes. My feeling is that dealers have lobbied for this so they can kick a lot of these old cars off the road and force people to buy newer or used cars at inflated prices.
Okay,
and it's also
Richard,
a way for the state to gather more fees.
Richard, thanks for that explanation. Governor, what do you think here?
Well, I have looked into this a bit. I may be the only governor in the country that has their inspection license, so I actually have one now. The business that I was previously with, we inspect our own vehicles, so I had my mechanic's license to do so. So I did look into this because I heard about this on the campaign trail. I've just started digging into it, actually. And part of what he's saying is correct. There's a very expensive piece of equipment that is going to be needed for anyone who's doing inspections. The thought behind this, and again, I'm not saying I agree with this, but the thought behind it was to make sure that people don't shop for inspections. So if they have they're found to have defective equipment at one facility, they might go to another and determine the other inspection station might not see it the same way. So what this does, this proposal is where they would take a picture of the defective equipment, whatever it is, and then send it in to Motor Vehicle for their advice, and to also shop to others so that you wouldn't be able to go someplace else and get by the inspection process. But I agree with what you're saying. I've seen this time and time again throughout the number of years. It's almost like this somewhat of a ripple effect on someone's life when they go and have their vehicle inspected. They find something that's not working. Typically, it's a light. The light dash light doesn't work or is defective, or the emissions light in particular, and it's really just a faulty switch. And so that shuts them down. They're not able to get their vehicle inspected. And so they continue to drive because they can't afford to have it fixed. And then they get caught for no inspection. And then what happens from there, I've seen again time and time where they fail to pay their fine because they can't afford to, but they still have to work. And then pretty soon they're on this spiral path downward that leads them to really adverse conditions. So the bottom line is we're taking a look at that. I would like some a little more flexibility, latitude. I would agree there are some areas where the vehicle is unsafe and it shouldn't be on the road, but there are some that you know it doesn't cause the accident as the caller had pointed out. It was more driver error than anything else. But there has to be you know something in between that we can get to.
What about the central question, though? Is your inspection sticker going to come from the local mechanic, or does it have to be reviewed by somebody in Montpelier?
No. What happens is that inspection station will do business just the way they always have. But if there's a question, they will take a picture of whatever the questionable defect is and send it in for clarification. If your vehicle passes inspection, the inspection station will still issue the sticker.
And so you want
just like you have been doing.
Okay. Let's see if we can get a quick question in from Nick in Chelsea. Hi, Nick. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hi, Bob. Hi, Governor Scott. I moved to Vermont about 5 years ago, and a big reason was the natural beauty, openness, and relatively smart development that's taken place here over the last many decades. I was wondering what the governor thinks about Act 250 and what kind of development is right for Vermont, having come from the construction industry.
Well, again, Act 250, some points is determined as being anti-development. I'm not sure that I share in that consistently. We have a permit process in place. Act 250 was brought forth to protect us from overdevelopment, and I think mission accomplished in one respect. But at the same time, we do need to have some development, and I don't want to see Act 250 utilized as an anti-development tool. It's there to protect our natural beauty, and I think there's still an opportunity to have both. That we can thread the needle. I'm a lifelong Vermonter, grew up here, don't want to see overdevelopment because I value what we have. And I think that can be utilized as a resource for attracting more into the state like yourself. So it's all about balance. But for those who misuse Act 250 to stop every piece of development that comes through, I think that is inappropriate as well. So there has to be a balance.
We got this email from Dennis about the Ethics Commission that's been proposed in the Senate. What are your thoughts about that? Does Vermont need an Ethics Commission?
I have said consistently that I don't mind having an Ethics Commission. I believe it's about transparency. If we don't want to... If we want to reinstill that faith and trust that's been lost for government in general across the country and the state, then we have to act appropriately, and transparency is part of the answer. I don't want to create another level of bureaucracy. I don't want to have something that costs us millions of dollars a year just to administer. So we'll take a look at what they're contemplating. We want to make sure that it protects Vermonters and that we do act responsibly and ethically. So if they come up with something that that doesn't prevent people from running for office just because they own a business, for instance, because I truly believe that we need people from all walks of life to be successful in the legislature. But we'll take a look at it.
got just about 30 seconds left. What about the whole revolving door idea that people from your administration might not be able to go into the private sector in an area where they have been active in state government? How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I believe that there is a standard, the moral standard we need to set, and we do have in place. We don't want if we want to reinstill that faith and trust that's been lost, we have to act appropriately, and we'll do so as well. This administration will act ethically.
Governor Scott, many thanks for being on the program today. I hope you'll come back on a regular basis.
We will. Thank you very much for having me on.
We certainly covered a lot of budget topics today, and here's one more. How does Vermont pay for the cleanup of Lake Champlain and other waterways? The Treasurer's Office will release its report this weekend, and then Monday on Vermont Edition, we'll comb through the details of how the state can raise $1.3 billion to restore Lake Champlain. Be sure to listen Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sangari, Sam Gale Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.